welcome to the first Yes to Life show of 2021 on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show for more than 5 years and founder of the UK charity that the show is named after, Yes to Life, that supports people in the UK in responding to a diagnosis of cancer in a holistic way using integrative medicine. My first guest on the show this year is a doctor who's a recent new resource for support with integrative cancer care in the UK, but one who has definitely hit the ground running, quickly becoming a driving force for change and one of the most popular speakers at recent events. Dr. Ariane Tavakoli was keen to join me today to share some top tips from her practice in Sussex, important pointers that she's observed firsthand from her clinical support of people with cancer. Welcome back to the Yes to Life show, Ariane.
Thank you, Robin. Lovely to be here and to speak with you again.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And for today's show, the very first of 2021, I've been guided by you, in as much as in our emails leading up to today, you indicated you're keen to share some insights you gained around issues you found crop up regularly amongst the people you're supporting through cancer, things to avoid, areas to focus on, that kind of thing. So the first topic on your list for today is engaging, by which I'm assuming that you're referring to the move away from passive recipient of treatment to active participant when it comes to both decision making and practical activity.
Yes, that was a good summary, actually. That's exactly what I meant. So, yes, just to step back a bit, as you know, I've been focusing on only seeing people with cancer in the past year and a half now. That's what my clinic's dedicated to. And I've seen a lot of people in that time. And I've just been picking up some, you know, some patterns, some recurring kind of themes. And I know there's the Radical Remission book where Dr. Kelly Turner picked up, you know, her 9 or 10 different areas that commonality between people who did very well. And I've also been, I guess, picking up my own clinical observations as time goes on, both for people who I've been finding are doing quite well, and also those who may be not doing as well as they could be. So I thought I'd just share some of those clinical observations.
Okay.
And you're quite right. So engaging was the first thing, and it might sound a bit odd to say that because you'd think that anyone who, you know, consults with a doctor or a healthcare practitioner would be willing to engage with that person. But and that's the case for the majority, of course. But I have to say, I have seen a number of people who really are kind of taking a back seat, right, and are preferring their loved ones and their relatives to do all of the work, basically. And of course, if someone is not mentally or physically fit, that's entirely understandable. You know, I'm not talking about that group of people. But there are some people who are, you know, well, mentally and physically, and who are capable of doing research. But I'm still finding out that some people are relying on maybe their husband or their wife or their son or their daughter to do all the research, to do all the communication, to read all the information after appointments. And so I found that that doesn't really place them in the best position, because really, you know, when you're receiving treatments, whatever that might be, it's always best if you fully understand what you're receiving, because then you can also have faith in it. You know, it's important to believe in what you're doing as well.
Right.
And that's more difficult to do when that information is being filtered through someone else, even if it's through a loved one. Now, the people this refers to will not be listening to this recording. It will be their relatives listening to this recording.
Interesting.
So,
good point.
So if that's the case, and you know who you are out there, if that's the case, I just want to encourage you to perhaps hand over at least one rein to your loved one and just encourage them to take the front seat, even if it's sometimes, because it really is better for them to be kind of fully engrossed in what they're doing and what they're receiving, because it will also give them more faith and belief in what they're receiving in terms of treatment. And that's really important. So that was the first thing I wanted to share.
Okay, well, that's a very interesting point. And it's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum from
this thing about people not getting enough support, and I think you're talking about somebody getting too much support, funnily enough.
I guess, but you can understand that. Obviously, relatives want to do their best, but sometimes it's not always the best thing for someone to have everything done for them. You know, that proactive stance really does make a difference.
Well, yes. Yeah, particularly when we're talking about something which is potentially a survival issue, you really need people to engage as fully as possible.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm. Okay, so you mentioned another closely related topic, which is understanding the integrative approach. So I'm guessing that you want to talk about this as, you know, apart from the empowerment that it brings, if you actually understand it yourself, it's so key to getting the best results. I mean, many people, I think, these days do actually appreciate what CAM, if you like, can add to help in areas that conventional treatment doesn't address. But it's really treatment synergies that are so little appreciated generally. I think this is not just the public, this is the professionals as well, that lift integrative medicine to another level, quite beyond simply adding in a few complementary therapies to your conventional treatment. Am I heading in the direction that you're thinking?
Yes, absolutely. There were several things in this area that I picked up, and I completely agree. A truly integrative approach is about bringing together the best of what conventional medicine can offer with the best of what is currently considered not conventional but is still evidence-based. So right. I don't want to call it alternative medicine because you know, a lot of things that we use in an integrative approach has a big evidence base, but it may not have reached, you know, national protocols and national guidelines yet because, you know, for various reasons.
Right.
But the things that I wanted to particularly point out are I have seen a number of people who really want to do things naturally, completely naturally, to the point of avoiding all medications if possible.
Right.
And whilst I can completely understand, you know, wanting to keep things as holistic as possible, the thing is that, you know, sometimes some disease or illnesses are, you know, they can be really serious, obviously, and sometimes they need serious or drastic measures, including drugs, including medications. A particular scenario comes to mind when I was treating someone with pneumonia many years ago. This is going back to when I was a registrar. Mm-hmm. I think it was in Guy's Hospital. This is a long time ago. And I was seeing a woman when I was on call, an accident and emergency, and she'd come in with a raging pneumonia. It was a community-acquired pneumonia. And she had all the signs. She had a high fever. She had all the signs, the clinical signs in her chest of consolidation. Her chest x-ray confirmed that. And she was a very kind of holistic thinking person and really didn't want to receive intravenous antibiotics, which is what she wanted. And I remember talking to her and I remember saying, look, out of all the doctors in this hospital, you're probably speaking to the one who is most open-minded and most in favor of holistic approaches. But I'm still telling you that I really feel you need intravenous antibiotics because there is a mortality rate associated with pneumonia. You know, people still die of pneumonia unless it's treated. It can be a very serious disease. And eventually she agreed. She had the intravenous antibiotics. She improved and she was discharged. She was well. I really don't think that would have happened. I've seen people dying of pneumonia,
right.
Fit people with strong immune systems. But the thing is, some of the you know, organisms and bacteria or conditions we're dealing with, they're very virulent. Even if you have a very strong immune system, even if you're doing everything right in terms of diet and supplements, sometimes it's just not enough. And sometimes you really need that strong medicine to just get in there. And if you're worried about the microbiome or whatever, okay, of course it's going to disrupt that for a while. But you can deal with that later. You can, you know, replenish your gut microbiome or whatever else you need to do. So I guess what I'm saying is sometimes it's necessary to go in there with the big guns. So please remain open and don't just close off all possibilities by wanting to stay completely holistic.
Right. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've come across people who are thinking in that way. And in a way, they're not being open-minded, really, unfortunately. And I think if you want to stay alive, you've got to be open-minded. I think, you know, if you fail to do that, you really are taking a massive risk. And that's, but in both directions, you know, if you fail to be open-minded about integrative medicine when you're just going for conventional medicine, you could be taking a similarly high risk, I feel. And so I think it's incredibly important to be broad-minded about it and to listen to everybody who comes along with an expert view and take it all on board before you make your decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I also see people who, when we're talking about metabolic pathways of cancer, you know, I talk about supplements and repurposed drugs, and some people really just prefer to take the supplements, the natural botanicals like curcumin and berberine, all of which are wonderful, of course. Yeah. They don't want to take the repurposed drugs like metformin or statins, for which there is a huge amount of evidence, actually, in some types of cancer. But one thing that I think a lot of people forget, and I find myself repeating this often, is that a lot of the studies done on the metabolic pathway blockers, on the botanicals, are laboratory studies. So there is a Petri dish, and that Petri dish has some cancer cell lines. It might be prostate cancer or breast cancer or whatever. And the scientist comes along with their high-dose botanical like resveratrol or whatever, curcumin, puts it in the Petri dish and then observes the reactions and then might observe the biochemical pathways that have been blocked. Now, it's very different when we're talking about a Petri dish with a few lines, you know, a single layer of cancer cells and a solid tumor in a human being.
Right.
You know, it will be very difficult to, I think it will be very optimistic to think that if we take curcumin, as wonderful as it is and as much as I support it, but I think it would be very optimistic to think that that will entirely block the pathway that we're looking at. It will certainly inhibit it to a certain extent, but that's the reason we take a synergistic combination, you know, in order to inhibit the pathways as much as possible and the repurposed drugs on top. So again, I encourage people not to completely rule out the medications. They can be really effective in that regard as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's prudent to just be aware of the fact that no one's got all the answers, whether they be a natural therapist or a conventional one. And, you know, in very few cases can anybody say this is going to do the job. Hence, we need to be open-minded. I think, you know, the natural approaches have their shortcomings, just as the drug approaches do. But we have to work with what we have.
Absolutely. And that actually leads me to the other observation I made under the importance of an integrative approach. And that is that, you know, sometimes you hear stories of people doing really well with one thing. Right. Like fenbendazole, for example, and a stage four cancer disappears, or CBD oil, and everything goes away. And you know, these are very vocal people who say, well, this worked for me, and
this is
the way.
Yeah,
but then, you know, how many people is that relevant to? How many people will achieve that degree of resolution with just using one thing? Very few, in fact. So it's about not putting all your eggs in one basket. It's about, as you say, remaining open to different things. That's the whole thing about integrative medicine. It's about approaching cancer at all angles. Don't just look at one thing. That, in fact, in my opinion, will be a dangerous thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Another important thing that I've noticed over the years is that what's a good solution at one time isn't necessarily a good solution at another time for the same person.
Yes, absolutely, because cancer, of course, is very metabolically flexible. Mm. So, you know, this is another thing I talk about often with the people I see, is that, you know, if we just, for example, block a few metabolic pathways with time, whether that's 3 months or 6 months or later, cancer cells do reroute, and they can even activate pathways that they have never used before. That's what cancer does. It's very flexible. So you're quite right. Things can change. Actually, just achieving stability is also a good thing. So again, this is something I repeat quite a lot. You know, all of these integrative kind of approaches can take time. So even if it's achieving stability, that can be a very positive thing. In fact, I I liken cancer to a speeding truck sometimes. I find it's helpful to think along those lines, because with a speeding truck, a lot of energy is put into just slowing it down and stopping it. Right. In fact, most of the energy is put into just slowing it down.
Yeah.
And to begin with, it can take time to slow it down. And then gradually you start slowing down and eventually you stop it. And then it's even more energy to then to get it to go into reverse. So, you know, we mustn't kind of expect things to happen overnight. This isn't like giving intravenous chemotherapy or radiotherapy, which can have fairly immediate results. An integrative approach can take time. And so I do kind of encourage people not to get too disappointed as well if things don't happen immediately.
Right.
It can take time to achieve results.
Okay, yeah. All right, so... another topic on your list for today is something that I know for many people is hugely unfamiliar territory that they really struggle to come to terms with, even in the face of a situation as critical as a diagnosis of cancer, and that's prioritising themselves. What can you tell us about this?
Yes, yeah. Again, you think it's strange to not prioritise yourself in such a serious condition, but... Again, I have seen quite a few people kind of delaying things because holidays are coming up or Christmas is coming up, or they're just too busy with children, busy with young children, busy with life. And then something happens, you know, and that something might be, well, we all know that cancer can progress hard and fast and create real problems. For example, you know, a bony metastasis that creates a collapse of a vertebra, that can be incredibly painful, hugely painful, resulting in, I've seen this actually, and resulting in hospital admission, resulting in surgery. And then from being, you know, completely physically able, one day you're, you know, in huge pain and difficult to do anything the next. And I don't want to, of course, you know, create depression or anything, but it's just... This is not a condition where you can afford to delay anything. If I've just said that an integrative approach can take time, you know, it can take several months for repurposed drugs or supplements or all of these things to start really fully taking action. So I would really encourage everyone, if you're really busy, which I know you all are, if maybe you've got young children or whatever, to arrange to give your children away to your grandparents, maybe for the weekend, to your parents, their grandparents for the weekend, and spend a couple of days really brainstorming with your partner, with friends, and researching and really coming up with a concrete plan for yourself, because this delaying really, I've seen it time and again, it really can cause issues because there may come a time when actually you could have done something, but it's now a bit late. You know, things progress quickly with cancer. Mm. So please do prioritise yourself. Don't delay things.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that thing about dreaming you've got time is, yeah, I can share that experience. That people think that it's, you know, they have a bit of time on their hands because it's early days or whatever it is. They're actually, in a way, squandering the best time they've got to find out what to do, to make the arrangements, all the rest of it. And, you know, I found particularly the time that people want to do that, funnily enough, is often when they've finished a round of treatment and they're actually feeling quite well, or they're in between treatments and they're feeling well, and there's some part of them just wants to get back their normal life, you know. And they actually spend that, you know, that 3 months of normal life doing the thing, whatever that is, it may be quite mundane. And then at the other end, they're suddenly in a crisis situation again, and they've got no time to do anything about it. And they haven't really capitalized on the ground that was gained in the last round of treatment either. So it's a very sad thing when that happens, I feel.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And often I find myself saying to someone in that position where they've just finished a course of treatment and there's no evidence of disease. And I say to them, look, you're in a very strong position right now. You're in a strong position because I see people who aren't even physically fit enough to take all the supplements that we integrated right. doctors often advise. You know, they can't even physically take them.
Right.
It's just too much for them. So I say to them, to people who are fit, you're able to do this now. You can do it now physically. That may not be the case in 6 months' time. So before that happens, you know, this is the time. This is the time you really need to hit it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, stem cells often linger around and you can't pick them up on scans. You don't know they're around. You don't know if a course of chemotherapy has really killed everything. Often it doesn't. So now is the time when you're well, when you've just finished your course of treatment, to really hit it with all the integrative approaches.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is your experience that there are any particular groups of people who are likely to, not really get moving at the beginning or whatever, who are likely to delay things?
Honestly, I find it's those who are just really busy with life. You know, young children, work, different things going on, you know, and it comes back to this thing about prioritizing yourself. And I know it can be difficult with family and young children, but at the end of the day, that's what needs to happen. You have to prioritize yourself. Yeah,
well,
difficult.
It is difficult. I like your advice of actually clearing a weekend, you know, where you remove those kind of responsibilities so you can actually focus. It makes a lot of sense, rather than trying to fit it in around all the usual stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So another thing you mentioned was getting professionals to help you. What were you thinking particularly when you said you'd like to speak about that today?
So I've come across a number of people who, particularly, for example, thinking of things like intravenous vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
I've come across a number of people who kind of self-treat at home with intravenous vitamin C. I've seen that quite often. And I've come across complications with that, because I think something that isn't appreciated fully is that intravenous vitamin C isn't safe for everyone. There are definite contraindications.
Okay.
It is a therapy that requires intravenous access with all of those potential complications.
Mm-hmm.
It can lead to issues. It needs to be monitored. There needs to be a blood test done beforehand to check for safety. So, you know, it is something that's best delivered where you're being monitored. I've seen a couple of people who've been delivering not even high dose intravenous vitamin C. It's like 15 grams, 20 grams a day, which is kind of a moderate. It's not a particularly high dose, but regularly, you know, for months.
Yes.
And they've ended up with kidney stones, which are, again, hugely painful.
Mm.
Ended up in hospital, needed those treating. And so that is one thing I've seen developing in a couple of people who've used it continuously. I say continuously, for several months.
Right.
That's one thing. Another thing is, for example, it's always best to check that it's safe. Of course, I said it's not safe in everyone. It shouldn't be given in people with a history of kidney disease, in people with a history of kidney stones. If there's anyone who has excess fluid anywhere, like ascites, fluid gathering in the abdomen, or a pleural effusion, which is fluid just outside the lungs, in the lining of the lung, or even cerebral edema, you know, fluid in the brain. All of that can get worse with high-dose intravenous vitamin C. It's because what you're doing is you're giving a very high dose of sodium. It's a
right.
bit like infusing salt in a way. Where there's a lot of sodium, it will attract more water. So those areas where there's already fluid will expand. And if there's no room for expansion, like outside the lung or in the brain, then that can cause serious issues as well. So, you know, with all of this, it's always best to, rather than do a DIY job, really get professionals, because there can be dangers associated with integrative therapies.
Mm.
Another one is repurposed drugs, of course. You know, they are drugs, they are medications, and all medications can come with a list of potential adverse effects. And at the end of the day, it's up to the person to make an informed choice if they wish to take that medication or not, knowing fully, you know, the information about it. But they do need monitoring. They may need blood tests, such as regular liver function tests. They need some sort of follow-up. So again, although I can understand, you know, people wanting to access certain repurposed drugs that can be difficult, I would always advise to get them through a professional, through a doctor, get them prescribed and have the appropriate follow-up and monitoring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense across the board, really, with cancer, I think. You know, that's what we always advise at Yes to Life, is that people do actually consult professionals, particularly at the beginning when they're you know, people do become remarkable experts on themselves and on what the treatments they're using. But that does take time. And if you just look at somebody who's been doing it for 5 years and says, say to yourself, I'll go off and do that, you're actually taking a lot of risks. Maybe only on the level of doing things that are a waste of time, doing them badly, wasting money. Wasting precious opportunities to actually help yourself. So there's so many reasons to get the best advice, really.
Yes, absolutely. And then that's also where organisations like Yes to Life come in really valuable, because, of course, you have a long list of medical professionals on the site.
Yeah.
So, you know, that information is available for people to find whatever therapy they're interested in, to find someone who can guide them in an expert way.
Yeah. So it seems like a large investment to do that, and it is really for most people, to be fair. But it's one of those things that could cost you a lot more if you don't do it, really, either financially or in terms of your health.
Yes, I agree. That's why I'm bringing up this point, because I have seen people develop serious complications because they didn't seek that professional advice to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. So the next thing for attention today is what you call core territory for people with cancer, and that's dealing with emotional baggage. Even for those rare people who don't arrive at a diagnosis of cancer with a mountain of unresolved issues, unmet needs, unfulfilled desires, there is still all the emotional baggage of the people around them to be contended with. So, a diagnosis of cancer simply has this effect of bringing all these things up to the surface, often pretty much simultaneously. So what can you tell us that could help people deal with this?
Yes, it's such a massive area, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in a way, it's not easy, but it's relatively easier to deal with the physical things, isn't it? To take the supplement, the repurposed drugs, and I don't know, do the therapies. But when it comes to dealing with our emotions, well, that's pretty, that's challenging for all of us. And one thing that I've found is a major block is anxiety. Mm. Anxiety just really, really messes everything up. I mean, it makes it difficult to take information on board, to retain information. You know, you're in a constant state of fear, really, with anxiety, fear of what could happen, I guess. And that's the big block. And the first thing is, I guess, really just acknowledging that it's an issue, because, again, not everyone does, or maybe they acknowledge it, but then push it under the carpet. But it really does need to be dealt with. And what I often say to people I see is, we can throw all these things at you. We can throw lots of supplements and medicines and all these different therapies. But at the end of the day, what's most powerful is what's going on in your mind. Mm. That's the most powerful thing.
Right.
And we know that because we know through, for example, functional MRI scanning, we know that what we think, and for example, if we're doing something, or if we're just thinking we're doing it, the same areas of the brain light up.
Right.
So your brain doesn't really differentiate between reality and what you're imagining, your imagination. It won't believe what you're saying. So if you're saying something repeatedly to yourself or believing something repeatedly, then that has an impact on the immune system as well. You know, it will have a physiological impact. And again, we know this because there have been lots of studies on this. I mean, one of them was just bringing to mind one, I think we discussed this before, but it's a randomized controlled trial of 80 women with breast cancer, mm-hmm. who were undergoing chemotherapy, and half of them had just the chemotherapy, and the other half were shown how to use their imagination, just using visualization and imagery, using their imagination to think of their immune system dealing with the cancer and eradicating the cancer cells. And then after the study, blood tests were taken from the two groups, and the group that were using their visualization skills, their imagination, had improved immune markers. So it had had a physiological impact on them. Their natural killer cell activity went up. Their T cell activity, cytotoxic T cell activity, went up. So we know that how we think does create an impact. And so having something like anxiety can be a major issue.
Right.
And I really encourage people to focus on finding any way that any therapy that they feel an affinity with, and that can be different for everyone. You know, some people respond more to talking therapies like counseling or psychotherapy. Other people respond more to maybe energetic therapies, or maybe to emotional freedom technique or tapping or heart math or neurolinguistic programming. There are just so many things out there, but just find a therapist who can help you. Even hypnotherapy, for example, can be huge, can be so beneficial for anxiety. Mm. So really important to acknowledge that it's there, and then to find someone that you feel comfortable with, that you feel you can trust, and deal with it. You know, ask that professional to help you to deal with it. Because the other thing we know about, you know, when our emotions are high and there's all these stress hormones rushing around in our body, which is natural after a diagnosis of cancer, is that cancer cells have receptors for these things. You know, cancer cells have receptors for adrenaline and noradrenaline. These are called adrenergic receptors. Mm. And these are some of the receptors we want to block with these supplements and repurposed drugs, but they are there, and the cancer cells can upregulate them when they sense that there is a lot of adrenaline floating around in the system. They will create more adrenaline receptors on their surface to bring in the adrenaline and use that to proliferate. So there are physiological and physical reasons why we need to address the emotional area. Mm. That's really important. So what I say to everyone is just, you know, I might point them to certain practitioners or certain therapies if I feel they'll help you. But at the end of the day, it's a personal thing. You know, everyone, as I say, responds differently to different therapies. So just do some research and find something that you feel an affinity with, and find a professional in that area that you feel you can work with, and then just do it. You know, you must address the emotional area because it has a very significant physical impact.
Mm-hmm. All right, really good to underline that. I mean, this is also an area in which the kind of mindfulness and relationship with nature and all that kind of stuff can also play in, can't it?
Yes, absolutely. Mindfulness, meditation, going out for a walk, deep breathing, all of these things, all of these natural things that we're kind of, all of us are probably not doing enough of. Yes, so important to address.
All right. So although I'm certain you don't mean it in that way, remembering to laugh, which is another topic you want to talk about, could on the face of it sound like something that's in a similar territory to be positive, a kind of patronizing outside view of cancer that's short on reality and likely to generate an angry response. But as I said, I'm confident you're not going there. So what exactly are you wanting to say by telling people to remember to laugh?
What I'm really getting at there is that, as we all know, you know, cancer is a very serious situation. Things can just feel really heavy and serious, and everything gets very heavy. It's just something that can really weigh us down, and that can impact on the immune system again. And so when I say remember to laugh, what I mean is, you know, bring in, it's really important to bring in some aspect of your life that really you really love, things that you really love doing, and things that make you laugh. So I often say to the people I see, you know, at the end of the day, instead of watching the news or reading a newspaper and reading bad news, don't do that. Instead, put on a funny comedy clip, even if it's a 5-minute video on YouTube, or watch a comedian and really laugh, because if you can, because, you know, that again does affect our immune system in a very powerful way. Mm. And I often advise the people I see, you know, when you wake up in the morning, try to get into the habit of saying a maybe a prayer of gratitude or just some positive affirmations. Just think of what you're grateful for, what you love in your life, what's going well, what's good in your life. And just other things like stroking pets or cuddling your partner or watching a comedy together or doing anything that you love. These are powerful things. These really do affect our immune system. And you know, it's been shown that just receiving a massage or receiving a stroke increases our natural killer cell function.
Right.
So it's not just that. It's not just about improving our immune system, even though these things do. They're very powerful at doing that. But it's just bringing back a sense of lightness, bringing back a sense of just removing that heavy burden from our shoulders. And the best time to do that, I think, is last thing at night. Well, all the time, really, but particularly last thing at night before sleeping. Mm. So, yeah, that's what I suggest to people I see.
All right. Well, it's interesting, that thing about something that you find funny, isn't it? Because you can feel, even when you're in a condition where you think you ought to be upset or, you know, whatever, or a bit down, if something makes you laugh, you can sort of feel the tussle going on between being that thing pulling you down and the laughter actually pulling you out of yourself, away from that situation, and becoming much more sort of extrovert, if you like. It's a funny feeling when something's making you want to laugh, even though you think you shouldn't be in that state.
Yes, I really like how you put that, Robin. Yes, that's a really good way of putting it. Totally agree.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing from that point of view. It just simply lifts you out of the doom and gloom which you might be ruminating over, which much of which, of course, is made up because, you know, it's us predicting an uncertain future.
Yes, yes. So those were the areas that I thought I'd just share as things that I've just kind of picked up. That I thought might be helpful.
Yeah, well, that's really great. So I was going to say that one of the important aspects of the practitioner view is the opportunity it offers to notice patterns amongst clients. So for each of the people with cancer, it's a unique situation that they're dealing with, and they're probably unaware that they share many responses or concerns or symptoms or needs or challenges with others who are facing similar circumstances. And that's where the accumulated wisdom that can hugely shortcut finding much-needed solutions comes in. Can you tell us a bit about some of the patterns that you've been noticing in your clients with particular conditions and how this can help in anticipating and resolving issues for them?
Yes, so I have indeed picked up some kind of recurring themes with the different types of cancer. And the first thing to say is, of course, I don't want to be compartmentalizing anyone. I'm speaking very generally.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying may, of course, it may not refer to everyone with that cancer, of course. It's a very general kind of observation. But I have noticed a recurring themes, actually, in people I see with, let's say, breast cancer, okay, or people I see with urological cancers. Yeah, I don't want to offend anyone, so I just want to make it clear that I am generalizing.
Sure.
And these aren't things that have been kind of medically proven or anything. This really is literally just my observations of what's been recurring. So what I've noticed with, I would say, almost 100% of the people I see with breast cancer, and this is women and men with breast cancer, mm-hmm, is that the emotional area is really strong. So I'm talking about stress, a history of anxiety or ongoing anxiety, a history of significant depression, or recent significant trauma. And I don't mean kind of emotional trauma that all of us experience, you know, from time to time. I mean really severe trauma, life-changing trauma. And I see this kind of huge amount of stress, and it comes out particularly in people with breast cancer. I'm not seeing the same degree. Of course, it may be present, but it's just not emphasized so much in people I see with, let's say, colon cancer or ovarian cancer or lung cancer. But in the people I see with breast cancer, it really is. So either there's a history of significant depression or a history of anxiety or significant stress. So, you know, young women who are juggling a high-profile job, maybe a managing director of a company, juggling that with family responsibilities, with sick relatives, with, you know, just running themselves thin, running themselves into the ground with all of this high amount of stress. And I see that with a lot with the breast people with breast cancer. And I think in future, we will somehow be able to identify the mechanism for this and why these sorts of highly stressful situations can lead to a higher risk of certain cancers, such as breast cancer. So, I don't know how that will kind of help in terms of going forward, but it's just something that I've noticed is particularly prevalent in people with breast cancer.
Okay. Well, that would be useful information to people to know that ahead of time, in a way, that's likely to be an issue to look at. We're short on science, in a way, but it certainly is a subject matter that comes up. I mean, you know, our experience at our recent conference 2 weekends worth was that almost every speaker spoke about stress as being an important factor. And it seems that from observation of professionals like yourself, this is certainly the case.
Yes. And I don't know if the listeners will have heard of this kind of approach to medicine. It's called German New Medicine or Germanic New Medicine. There are some very interesting theories in that, and it's very much, and they do come up with some kind of mechanisms, physiological theories and possible mechanisms for how trauma can actually lead on to malignancy. But they often talk about loss, so recent bereavement or loss in some way, and how that can often be linked with a diagnosis of cancer later on.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to look up the German New Medicine as well.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Any other patterns that have jumped out at you like that?
So there were a couple of others. The second one was urological cancers. So things like kidney cancer, bladder cancer, prostate cancer. And I've found that a lot of people I'm seeing with these malignancies have had a very significant exposure to toxins. Now, again, I know toxin exposure can be a general thing. A lot of us are exposed to toxins. But again, it seems to be a kind of a major thing in a lot of people I'm seeing with these cancers. Sometimes significant exposure to lead paint, for example, or significant exposure in some kind of occupation that they've been in, where they've either been breathing in a significant amount of toxic chemicals, or they've been exposed to it through their skin. And of course, a lot of chemicals will end up being excreted through the kidneys. They might sit for a long time in the bladder, in the urine, before voiding. So maybe that's a possible mechanism. But that's, again, just something I've noticed, that a lot of people I'm seeing with these sorts of urological, urothelial cancers have had a very significant exposure to some sort of toxin. Often it's been lead, interestingly. And then the other one, interestingly, is neuroendocrine cancers. And I've noticed that a few of the people that I've seen with this, again, you know, I am generalizing, but a few of the people I've seen have really had issues with suppressed anger. And that's interesting, because a lot of neuroendocrine cancers, of course, release serotonin. And what's serotonin? It's our happy hormone. It's a hormone which stabilizes our emotions, which reduces our level of, should reduce our level of anger and increase our level of happiness. And again, this is just an observation. I have no, you know, I have no scientific studies. I have no kind of proof of this. It's just an observation that I would say 80 to 90% of the people I've seen with neuroendocrine cancers, suppressed anger has been something significant, very significantly suppressed anger. I'm talking about almost rage in a way. Has been an issue. And it's very interesting to note that these cancers secrete serotonin. I wonder if it's a protective mechanism, you know, our body. Maybe we will find one day that some cancers are actually a protective mechanism that has gone awry.
I've heard that.
Just a theory.
Yeah, I've heard that spoken about. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, the observations of the type you're making are the beginnings of the science on the subject, of course, because at a certain point, if enough people observe it, somebody goes out there to find out, don't they? They actually run a trial to see what they can find out. So,
yes,
Yeah, yep. That's where it all starts. Yeah. So yes. Just to be clear, do you want to tell me the range of cancers that you're talking about, the neuroendocrine cancers? Which ones are we talking about?
Mainly I'm talking about the carcinoid, malignant carcinoid cancers. So it can affect anywhere really. Mainly the gut or the pancreas. There's a wide range really.
Right.
The people that I've seen have mainly had neuroendocrine cancers of the gastrointestinal tract.
Right. Okay. So thank you for that. Very interesting stuff. As we're at the very start of a new year, I like to end today by looking forward at the direction cancer treatments are taking, where the most recent developments are leading, and what approaches you think are going to turn out to have the most impact when it comes to helping people deal with cancer.
Well, I'm very excited for the new areas that I think we will bring into cancer treatment in the next few years. I've seen some studies that currently are preclinical, so they're laboratory studies, particularly in the areas of quantum medicine, so particularly looking at nanoparticles, metal nanoparticles, such as often magnetic metals, such as iron. Mm-hmm. So these are experiments using injected nanoparticles, iron nanoparticles, which are injected into the bloodstream. And these will preferentially accumulate into tumor tissues. And the reason they do that is because often cancer tissues will have, as you know, a kind of a blood supply around them. Mm-hmm. They have a large network of blood vessels. So, and these blood vessels also have a disruption in their endothelium. They're not normal blood vessels. So the endothelium often has wide gaps in it, allowing small particles like nanoparticles to pass through very easily. Okay. So the nanoparticles will kind of accumulate in cancer tissues. And they also have difficulty leaving because cancer tissues are often devoid of lymphatics, you know, leaving the area. So the accumulation is something called the enhanced permeability and retention effect.
Okay.
What this means is that injected nanoparticles will actually accumulate preferentially and stay in tumor tissues. So you wait for a while until that happens, and then when you identify that they are there, they've accumulated in the tumor tissue, these nanoparticles can then be activated. And because they're magnetic, they can be activated through either an alternating strong magnetic field, or they can be activated through different means, through radio waves, for example. Mm-hmm. And that causes them to heat up significantly. And that heat then destroys the local tumor tissue in which they've, you know, in which they're residing. And this has been shown in laboratory studies to deal with widespread metastatic disease, you know, within hours to within days. Now, this is obviously huge and exciting to me.
Yeah.
It hasn't come into the clinical realm yet, but I don't think it will be long. I think it will hopefully be within the next few years. So I think nanoparticles and their application to cancer treatments will be a very strong area to watch out for. Of course, we're using quantum medicine already in different fields in medicine now, for example, MRI scanning and different diagnostic methods. But I think quantum medicine, which I define as the application of quantum physics to the science of medicine, I think that will be more and more the future of cancer treatments. And it will involve treatments that will not involve poisoning, that will probably not involve surgery or radiotherapy. It will cause very few side effects, and it will be very effective very quickly. And I think this will come about within the next 10 years. I think this will come into the clinical realm.
Mm. It is extremely interesting. It's very like PDT in a way, where you're exposing the people to something which in itself is not going to do them any harm, you know, light, or in this case, it might be radio waves or whatever, to cause the damage. And if the actual, the medium, whatever it is that's being used, accumulates in the cancer itself, then the selectivity is already done ahead of time. It's like it's going to work in the places you want it to work. And it's extremely interesting. Yes. And it doesn't negate the need for integrative medicine, because of course it hasn't changed the environment at all, but in terms of dealing with the cancer, it could be amazing.
Absolutely. So you're quite right. The areas that we've just spoken about with integrative medicine remain hugely important, because, of course, we still want to prevent further malignancy. Mm. So all the areas of nutrition and lifestyle and dealing with stress and all of these, of course, go hand in hand together with treatments of the primary tumour. And you mentioned PDT or photodynamic therapy.
Yeah.
Yes, it is similar, very similar to that, because, of course, what we're doing is we're using an agent, in this case nanoparticles, and something that will sensitize it. So yeah. In PDT, there will be a photosensitizer, for example, that will be activated by light,
yes.
That will be activated by certain wavelengths of light, and then that will then destroy the tissue in which that agent has taken up residence. So, yes, it's very similar to that. So we're already using that technology now to a certain degree.
And, you know, it has such big advantages in terms of the fact that it's non-toxic, and you can have it many times in the same place without accumulating any sort of bad effect. So it's got an awful lot going for it, and it's not even expensive. I don't know how this treatment is going to be on the cost scale, but certainly PDT is relatively cheap now.
Yes. Well, we'll need to watch this space for the nanoparticles. Yeah.
And ask where is the sort of world leading research going on into this?
There are various groups. There are some European groups. There are some groups in China. I've seen a lot of papers in this area, and I can't recall the countries, but I know that there are various in Europe and there are various in the East as well. Lots of groups working on this.
Right.
It's a very kind of hot area within that area of research, the nanoparticle area of research and science.
Yeah, well, I have heard of it, but I haven't talked to anybody who knows anything much about it until now. So thank you.
It's a pleasure. And I think the other thing that we're heading towards really is precision oncology. It's about making treatments more individualized for the individual, more personalized. Mm. So again, that technology is available now, but it's often private and a bit pricey. But it is possible to test tumors genomic profiling, so looking at the genetic markers of different tumors and actually testing different chemotherapy agents and even different immunotherapy agents with that person's particular tumor to see which treatments will actually work for it, rather than just working blindly, which is what's happening really at the moment, following national protocols or guidelines, which are just the same protocol for every cancer, but is not individualized for the person. So there are companies that offer this now, even. One of them is Caris Life Sciences, if people want to research that. Mm. I think that some people are able to get some of this on the NHS, but that I haven't heard of that very often. Most often it has to be a private kind of testing, and it is costly. I think you're talking about a few thousand pounds there. But at the end of the day, it does provide a personal view of which treatments will actually work for your cancer. And then that's something that you can then share with your oncologist. So I think precision oncology is something that will hopefully become much more commonly used in the near future.
That would be good. Okay, time's up. So always very interesting to talk to you, Ariane. Thank you very much for sharing all that. And I hope our listeners will find some of that useful and interesting.
I hope so. Pleasure speaking with you, Robin.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
I always thoroughly enjoy talking to Dr. Tavakoli. She exudes a powerful combination of expertise and understanding and a deep care for the people she works with. Exactly the qualities anyone would want in their doctor. Thanks so much for joining me at the start of the new year. It's hard to see how 2021 is going to pan out, but I shall be doing my best to make one thing certain, and that's that the Yes to Life show will continue to showcase those at the cutting edge of integrative medicine for cancer right throughout the year. So I do hope you'll make a small New Year's resolution to make a point of joining me every week here on the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.